Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Glad you could make it. Hope you're going to stick around for a while, okay? As much as you can handle. You know, I certainly can appreciate that. You know, sticking around for as much as you can handle. McCain is really getting funky out there. I mean, he really is. It's getting crazier by the day. He made a trip to the Enrico Fermi nuclear power plant today. That's right outside my old hometown, Toledo, Ohio. It's not far from Detroit, Michigan, Toledo, Ohio. What else is up there? I think it's in Monroe, Michigan. But he visits the Enrico Fermi plant to talk about nuclear power. Do his handlers not know? Does he not know that the Fermi nuclear power plant has had a series of accidents, possible radiation leaks that could affect as many as 3 or 4 million people? It's astonishing. It's astonishing. Not just that, but as Art wrote to me, he said, "Mike, I see old Grandpa McCain's been pimping snake eyes to the bikers at Sturgis." This is out at the South Dakota motorcycle rally. Art writes, "I guess his pals in the press would just regard this as yet another example of McCain being a regular guy, maybe even a maverick. Another upstanding Republican family man. I'll bet the evangelical crazies are loving this." Art. Well, what Art's referring to is that McCain volunteered his wife for a cough, cough, blush, blush, beauty pageant yesterday that features topless contestants and occasionally more than that at the Sturgis, South Dakota motorcycle rally. McCain, why is he at a motorcycle rally? I don't quite get that, especially this sort of motorcycle rally. But anyway, he was at the rally and he was telling everybody while he's jabbing his finger, doing that little duck thing that he does with McCain. He said, quote, "I was looking at Sturgis' schedule and noticed you had a beauty pageant. So I encouraged Cindy to compete. I told her that with a little luck, she could be the only woman to serve as both the First Lady and Miss Buffalo Chip." Does he know what a buffalo chip is? Does he know what a cow pie is? Oh, my God, he's from Arizona, isn't he? Miss Buffalo Chip? The audience, who you can decide yourself if they were cheering his regular guyness or if they were laughing their asses off at what he just said, they cheered and whistled their approval. Yeah, get Cindy in here. Now, this rally, motorcycle rally, which, according to ABC News, is now in its 62nd year. What? They had motorcycles 62 years ago? I'm just kidding. It usually attracts about 500,000 riders in August to this town, Sturgis, South Dakota. It's a small town of about 5,000 people. And the contest is named for the Buffalo Chip Campground. Sure it is. And what's the campground named for? And McCain, according to the Buffalo Chip Campground website, was participating in, quote, the Buffalo Chip's annual tribute to American veterans and active duty servicemen, end quote. The site also says that many attendees are, quote, veterans and active duty servicemen who will have a great appreciation for McCain's family history of service to our country, end quote. He was also the opening rock for the opening act for Kid Rock, who came on after he offered his wife. Oh, Jesus. Why would veterans want anything to do with McCain? McCain is not a friend of veterans. McCain was like Oliver North, just crazy son of a bitch that never should have had the uniform of the U.S. military anywhere near his body, much less to get shot down in it, or like Oliver North did, go crazy in the Bethesda Naval Hospital trying to shoot everybody. Jesus. Remember the McCain ad that had a little cameo appearance of Paris Hilton and, who is the other one? Paris Hilton and, The other ditzy, the other Britney Spears. It's hard to keep them straight. Well, Paris Hilton has put out a response to it. Here it is. Here's Paris Hilton. Well, it's coming in a second. Here's Paris Hilton. All right, it's coming in a second. We have Paris Hilton responding.
Hey, America, I'm Paris Hilton, and I'm a celebrity, too. Only I'm not from the olden days, and I'm not promising change like that other guy. I'm just hot. But then that wrinkly white-haired guy used me in his campaign ad, which I guess means I'm running for president. So thanks for the endorsement, white-haired dude. And I want America to know that I'm, like, totally ready to lead. And now I want to present my energy policy for America. Just as soon as I finish reading this article on where I can fly to get the best tan. Oh, Maui. Loves it. Okay, so here's my energy policy. Barack wants to focus on new technologies to cut foreign oil dependency. And McCain wants offshore drilling. Well, why don't we do a hybrid of both candidates' ideas? We can do limited offshore drilling with strict environmental oversight, while creating tax incentives to get Detroit making hybrid and electric cars. That way, the offshore drilling carries us until the new technologies kick in, which will then create new jobs and energy independence.
What?
Energy crisis solved. I'll see you at the debates, bitches. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go pick out a vice president. I'm thinking Rihanna. I'll see you at the White House. Oh, and I might paint it pink. I hope that's cool with you guys.
Pink?
Bye.
Paint it pink?
I'm Paris Hilton, and I approve this message because I think it's totally hot.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Well, she does have a pretty good idea. Better than either McCain or Obama, her idea of how to solve the energy crisis, if you're going to insist on being an absolute inmate at an insane asylum and continue to use oil, non-renewable resources, carbon-based garbage. If that's your gig, if that's your idea, then Paris Hilton's idea is excellent. If you happen to read my blog today at novamradio.com, you know what Ron Suskin has done with a new book that he has out. He also wrote a brief piece at Huffington Post today to try to prep anyone who is going to read the book, or is not going to read the book for that matter. He writes, "What just happened, a secret that has been judiciously kept for 5 years, just spilled out. All of what follows is new, never reported in any way." And what Suskin is talking about is the Iraq intelligence chief, Tahir Jalil Habush, a man still who still has a $1 million price on his head for his capture. He's the Jack of Diamonds in Bush's famous deck of wanted men. Tahir Jalil Habush has been America's secret source on Iraq. Yeah, starting in January of 2003, with Blair and Bush watching, his secret little reports began to flow to officials on both sides of the Atlantic, saying that there were no weapons of mass destruction and that Hussein was acting so odd because of fear that the Iranians would find out that he was bluffing, that he was a toothless tiger, and they might come after him to whip his ass again. But our crack intelligence department, under the firm control of Dick Cheney, deep-sixed the intelligence report, resettled Mr. Habush to a safe house in Jordan during the invasion, and then paid him $5 million in what could only be considered hush money. Can you believe this? There's more. Don't go away. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Yeah, it's good, just too much. My blood runs cold. Yeah.
man conservatives love to hate. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. So Ron Suskin, the author, Ron Suskin. I'm sure you're familiar with his work. If you're not, you should be, right? He wrote today at Huffington Post, trying to tease. I don't know why I'm stuttering here. That really pisses off some of our listeners. Really pisses you off, doesn't it? Trying to tease the new book that he hands out. But he wrote that a secret has just leaked out, a secret that the Iraq intelligence chief, one Tahir Jalil Habush, this guy still carries a ransom on his, or a wanted, what do you call it, bounty on his head of $1 million. If you are so lucky as to capture him, you'll be paid $1 million by the Bush crime family. He's the Jack of Diamonds in Bush's famous deck of wanted men. He's the guy who explained to both the UK and US intelligence agencies that there were no weapons of mass destruction, that Hussein was acting so odd because he feared that the Iranians would find out he had nothing and come and get him again. So in order to silence this guy, the Bush crime family hid the intelligence report, resettled Mr. Habush in a safe house in Jordan during the invasion, and then paid him $5 million to keep his mouth shut. As Suskin further explains at Huffington Post, in the fall of 2003, after the world learned that there were no weapons of mass destruction, just like Mr. Habush had said, the White House ordered the CIA to carry out a deception. No. The mission for the CIA was to create a handwritten letter, create it, forge it, dated in July of 2001 from Mr. Habush to Saddam Hussein, saying in this forged letter that Atta, the so-called leader of the 9/11 crew, Mohammed Atta, that he had trained in Iraq before the attacks, and that Saddam was buying yellow cake in Niger with help from a small team from the Al-Qaeda organization. All of this, all of these lies, the CIA was ordered by Dick Cheney, one presumes, since George Bush is too much of a dumbass. But Cheney ordered this. Do this to the CIA. Remember all those trips he made out to CIA headquarters? Remember all that? Huh? Put the pieces together. So Cheney says to the CIA, all right, look, we've been getting all kinds of information from our little inside man over there, Habush, that there's no there, and that Saddam is wetting his pants because he's afraid that the Iranians are going to attack him again. So create something. I want you to get very creative here. Forge a document. Make something up. And so the mission was carried out. The letter was created. It popped up in Baghdad. It just churned the global news cycles in December 2003. Even venerable journalists like Tom Brokaw was sucked into this vortex. The mission that Cheney ordered the CIA to accomplish, the forging of this document, is a violation of the charter of the CIA to begin with, that prohibits the CIA from conducting disinformation campaigns on U.S. soil. See, we can do it anyplace else. You know, we can go to another country and start screaming the sky is falling. But we can't do it here. Well, that's what the law says. So, as Suskin writes, here we go again. The administration, in full attack mode, is now going after Ron Suskin. George Tenet, the head of the CIA, is claiming he doesn't remember anything like this, just like he couldn't remember saying slam dunk, that the invasion of Iraq would be a slam dunk. And reporters are scratching their heads. Everything in Suskin's book is on the record. There are no unnamed sources. And, you know, I don't know what to say. What the hell can you say? We watch and wait once again to see if anything happens. Like I wrote at the blog today, if Nancy Pelosi goes on ABC's The View and says, well, you know, if we had a reason to impeach him, yeah, is this not a reason? The name of the book is The Way of the World. It's coming out, or it came out today. And the book insists that this forgery was designed to portray this false link between Hussein's regime and Al-Qaeda as one of the justifications for the invasion, occupation of Iraq, and the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi citizens, and so far nearly 4,300 American soldiers. So that's not an impeachable offense either, right, Nancy? We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda.
See, it's stuff like that. I mean, just incredible lies that were told to the American people by Bush, by Cheney, by the head of the FBI, the head of the CIA, the Department of Defense, Department of State. I mean, all of them. And Nancy Pelosi says, if somebody would present me some evidence... Susskind's book is called The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism. And the information about the White House's plan to forge documents to persuade the American public that we should attack Iraq is mind-boggling. Susskind appeared on the Today Show and gave his first interview about the book. He says it's one of the great lies in modern political history. And Nancy Pelosi doesn't know what to do? Let me quote some of this. In the months before, this is not from the book, this is just preamble. In the months before the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq, British intelligence had secret meetings in Amman, Jordan, with Mr. Habush, chief of Saddam's intelligence network. Habush demanded a safe way out if and when the U.S. invaded. Habush repeatedly, you know, Habush is Arabic for family of Bush. Oh, well. Habush repeatedly told the British that Saddam had no weapons of mass destruction, that all programs had ended in the 90s. And the book says that the Bush White House didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to hear any more reports on what Habush was saying. So the U.S. invaded in March 2003. Habush was ready. He slipped out of Baghdad, according to the book, with the help of U.S. intelligence and into Amman, Jordan. He was working for the goddamn CIA. So in October of 2003, the CIA paid him $5 million as part of his resettlement in Jordan. And then the book reports this. By then, the White House had finally thought of a way to use Habush. The White House had concocted a fake letter from Habush to Saddam, backdated to July 1, 2001. It said that 9/11 ringleader Mohammed Atta had actually trained for his mission in Iraq, thus showing, finally, that there was an operational link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. The letter also mentioned suspicious shipments to Iraq from Niger set up with Al-Qaeda's assistance. The idea was to take the letter to Habush and have him transcribe it in his own neat handwriting on a piece of Iraqi government stationery to make it look legitimate. CIA would then take the finished product to Baghdad and have someone release it to the media. Even 5 years later, Rob Ricker, who worked in CIA for 30 years and was in charge of clandestine ops in the Middle East, and he's now working as an executive at Blackwater. That guy, Rob Ricker, remembers looking down at the creamy White House stationery in which the assignment was written. Quote, "The guys from the vice president's office were just barraging us in this period with one thing after another. Run down this lead, find out about that. It was nonstop. Of course, this, the letter, was different. This was creating a deception." Ricker passed the directive down the chain to the Iraq Operations Group. And it goes on, and on, and on, and on, and on. Create a letter, a forgery. Now, Jesus, God, the really incredibly, what's the word I'm looking for? I want to say ballsy, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on the air. I'll just try it. What the hell? The really ballsy part of this on the part of the CIA and Dick Cheney was the fact that they include Habush in their deck of the most wanted when he was a CIA operative that they were using to funnel lies and disinformation to the American public, to the British public, to the UN, to the world. Jesus God, do you understand what has happened to us? Does anybody get it that every single American, let's set aside the just countless numbers of Iraqi households that have been decimated by death and people being blown to bits and children and parents and I mean, God, set that aside for a second. American soldiers and the families of Americans who have contributed somebody to go into this lying, filthy meat grinder that Cheney and Bush and the rest of these bastards created out of air. I am afraid of what I would do if I were the father of someone, a soldier who had been killed in Iraq, and I heard about this. I tremble. It's so bad I dare not even say it on the air. At what I would do, come hell or high water, if one of my sons or daughters had been killed in Iraq because of what these murderous, lying bastards in the Bush administration have done. It just doesn't stop. Lie upon lie upon lie. The people who have been tortured, the people who have been imprisoned, held indefinitely. The teenagers, do you know how many people we have, the U.S. Provisional Authority, how many people we still have under our command, military U.S. military command, in prison in Iraq? The last figure I saw was around 40,000 Iraqi civilians who are locked up in jails, prisons. No charges, just suspicion of terrorism, suspicion of this. What the hell would you do if a country invaded your nation? If a military came in and started bombing and killing and you knew the whole thing was a goddamn lie? What would you do? I knew what I would do. I would try to kill every one of them. I don't care how I killed them. I would try to kill every single one who had invaded my country. But here we sit. Here we say, is this ever going to stop? And these sons of bitches running for office are talking about winning the war. McCain, well, we'll come home, my friends, when we win the war. And Barack Obama's talking about 16 months? What do you call it when you defend your country against an invader that has invaded your country based on lies, come there for, directly and with no qualification to steal your assets, your resources, to destroy you, to kill you, to blow up your country? What do you call it when you resist? Patriotism? Or insurgency? Give me a goddamn break. This is maddening, isn't it? Does it bother you? I don't know. Does anybody care about this? I would imagine people get so tired of tuning in this program every night and listening to this. Get over it, Malloy! That was 5 years ago! This is a book after book, just report after report, insider after insider, laying out the case over and over and over again, not just for impeachment of these bastards, but for their arrest and trial on war crimes. My God, this is an American government that has done this. Oh, well. I didn't get a chance to watch any network news tonight or any cable news all day. Is anyone talking about Ron Suskin's book? Is anyone talking about Habush? Are there any reports out there for the American people to get their brains around that more proof, more irrefutable proof? Is it irrefutable or is it just more garbage? Huh? Anyone care? I really wonder sometimes. I really do. If anyone cares. It does get frustrating, and I'm sure it does for you. It certainly does for me. Just continually banging the same drum, and nothing happens. Nothing happens. Absolutely nothing. Instance upon instance upon instance of the lies and deceptions. Is it not an impeachable offense to lie a country into a war? Is everything the Bush crime family, everything that they have done, is it not just an endless list? Was Dennis Kucinich not right? Are there not 35 areas that would constitute an article of impeachment against these people? Does it matter? Does it make any difference? Are we waiting for Obama, the savior, to walk across the Potomac River and stride into the White House on election or on inauguration day and save us all? What the hell? What are we waiting for? What? Let's take a break. We'll be back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Walk me out in the morning dew sometime.
Now, we've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
I'm sorry.
Ten before the hour, apparently Keith Olbermann devoted a huge chunk of time tonight to the Suskin book and also had John Dean on. Rachel Maddow addressed it, and Stephanie Miller talked about it too this morning. And Prairie 2 says whoever the guy is. What's the guy's name on NBC? Brian Williams. Gave it a few seconds that was then equally covered from George Tenet, who screamed that he wasn't involved or he didn't know what the hell the story was. I don't know. So what? First of all, other than NBC, other than Brian Williams, if it's on MSNBC or Stephanie Miller's program or this program or Oberman's program or Hartman's program or whatever, It's not official because those are not official mainstream media outlets. Not even Oberman. No, he isn't. He's, I don't know, he's a danger to the Republic, I guess. Hi. What's this? A 14-year-old has, all right, let's take the call. This is from Mark and Jay Lynn calling from Cartersville, Georgia. Who have I got, Mark or Jay? Yeah,
you have Mark, Mike.
Okay.
First of all, I just want to thank you for continuation of my education. Upon listening to you, you have really opened my world up to a lot of subjects that I wouldn't even really encompass, except for the fact that you are one that really has helped me out a lot. But
okay.
Nonetheless, my son was listening to you. I'm trying to get him to listen to you and to find out that there's more than one side to every story. And he was sitting here listening to you speak about soldiers. Presently, his mother is stationed in Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been there since the latter part of last year.
Right.
I myself, I'm a Gulf War vet and 10-year ex-military personnel myself.
Right.
And he heard you speak about why this country has gone to war under the false pretenses that it has.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of curious. He wanted to ask you himself, but all of a sudden he's gotten chicken. But nonetheless, I'll do the talking for
okay,
him.
Okay, go ahead.
He wants to know, he asked me, would his mother die in vain for this country for nothing?
You need to tell him that his mother is not fighting for this country. You decide, or she decides, or somebody decides what she's fighting for. But if she's in Kuwait, thank God she's only in Kuwait. She's not under fire, which doesn't mean that she won't wind up in a direct combat zone. But she's not fighting for the defense of this country. I mean, you know that.
That's correct, Mike. I do. In fact, as I explained to him, upon wearing a uniform, you have to take orders. And if those orders require you to be, if those orders require you to do the work of this country, then by all means, you have to do the work for this country of this country.
Up to a point.
Up to a point. I agree with you.
And you also need to let your son know about what laws were established after World War II at the Nuremberg trials. There are illegal orders that someone who like his mom, who takes an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies foreign and domestic, that there is also the idea in the Universal Code of Military Justice, the idea that an illegal order is one that a soldier does not have to obey.
Yes.
So, I mean, I don't know. I shudder to think what it would have been like when I was 14 to have my mom that close to a combat zone, especially because she didn't sign up. I doubt seriously if your 14-year-old son believes his mom signed up to join the military because she wanted to go kill people.
No.
She signed up to join the military probably because she saw it as a means of income, a way of serving her country honorably, and as a way of the benefits that come with military service. I bet your wife is either in the reserves or National Guard, right?
Exactly. We were. I met my wife at active duty, and upon me being deployed to the first Gulf,
right,
we decided then that this wouldn't be a way to solidify a foundation for a family, so we need to get out. However, my wife fell in love with the uniform, and being that it was pretty much peacetime, even up to that point in time, because not everyone in the military went to the first Gulf War,
right,
she thought that she can just skate to her 20 years was up. Well, unfortunately, that didn't occur.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people who joined the military in the 90s felt that way. But then along comes Bush and Cheney, who lie the nation into a war, lie mothers and fathers into a combat zone, lie 4,200 American soldiers into their graves, lie God only knows how many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis into their graves, all based on lies. I'll tell you, I hope, Mark, that Jay's mom, your wife, comes home. If I had any faith in religion at all, I would pray that she would return. And I know that you folks probably do it. I'm very uncomfortable talking to the 14-year-old son of a woman who has been shipped to Kuwait under false pretenses. I don't know what to say. I hope that Jay's mom makes it home okay. I'm sure she will make it home okay. But I don't know what else to say. Mark, thanks for checking in. I don't know if I was any help to you or not. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back. It's about 7 past the hour. James in Sylmar, California writes, Mike, Steve Inskeep on NPR's Morning Edition did a 7-minute interview with Susskind today. You can hear it and download it, James thinks, at npr.org. Okay, so there is some coverage of Susskind's book. That's a good thing. But and then interestingly, on AP Radio News that we carry on this network, the lead story is that, the thieves, the bastards, the cockroaches that are named in this book are denying. Oh, no, never happened. Never happened. No, never happened. All right. The phone number here, if you would like to jump in here now would be a good time, 800-989-1480. We'll work some phone calls in here, 800-989-1480. Here's a news flash for you. Dick Cheney is going to be a no-show at the Republican convention in Minnesota. Republican officials are saying that this was John McCain's idea. He doesn't want to be linked to Cheney. I don't know why anyone, I don't know why a ghoul, I don't know why a flesh-eating cannibal would want to be linked to Cheney. Who wants to be linked to this murderous, warmongering bastard? Who? But the fact is, John McCain is nothing but a product of the Bush-Cheney years. He wants to continue doing exactly what Bush and Cheney have been doing. So, kicking Cheney's ass out of the convention means nothing, absolutely nothing. Cheney will be there. Every time McCain opens his decaying mouth, it'll be Cheney who will be speaking. Why? Because it's Karl Rove and is it Richard Melman, whatever the guy, Melman, who ran Bush's reelection campaign. These are the guys operating with Dick Cheney, who have corrupted this country almost beyond belief. So when McCain says, no, Cheney's not going to be here, my friends, yeah, he will. Every time you open your mouth, you twisted freak. One Republican official told CNN there is a, quote, mutual understanding, end quote, between Cheney's office and the McCain campaign that Cheney is not going to attend the convention. A second Republican official said there are still, quote, talks going on, end quote, between Cheney's office and the McCain camp, and both sides are, quote, still trying to work it out, end quote. Oh, God. Cheney is still popular among conservatives. Why? Are all conservatives in this country brain dead? Have the rats gotten into your skulls, you freaks, eaten holes through your eardrums and gotten in and started chewing on your brains? How could anyone, especially a conservative, have anything to do with Dick Cheney? I'm not talking about a neoconservative. I'm talking about a conservative as defined by Merriam-Webster, a conservative as defined by the political system of this country. Maybe, oh, okay, well, that's the catch. 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, you people who claim to be conservative, you're not conservatives. You're corporatist fascist. No wonder you like Cheney. So don't call yourselves conservatives. You're not. A Wall Street Journal NBC News poll back in June showed that only 23% of Americans had a positive opinion of Cheney. And as CNN reports, Cheney may be the only non-incarcerated politician in America who's less popular than Bush. Non-incarcerated politician? Oh, Jesus. One can hope, can't one, huh? Nothing would make me more relieved, relaxed, ease whatever stress and tension, anxiety I feel, as seeing Dick Cheney in handcuffs being perp walked someplace into a federal detention center for trial in this country or to be renditioned to The Hague, where he would be put on trial for war crimes or crimes against humanity. I swear, if that day would ever occur, I would just, oh my God, it would be like, all right. That even might make me cast aside my humanistic point of view and believe in a God again. Okay, not really. The last vice president, according to CNN, who didn't show up at his party's political convention was Charles Dawes. Ever heard of him? He was Calvin Coolidge's vice president, and the convention occurred in 1928. So it's been almost a century since this has happened. I don't know why Cheney doesn't just burst in fully armed and just walk up to the stage.
You tried to keep me out of here, did you? You rat bastards. Well, here, eat hot lead.
And just open fire. You know, pull up about 40 Blackwater fully armed thugs standing behind him. Cheney, you didn't want me here? You really didn't want me here?
Well, you can go F yourselves. No, better yet, I'm going to have you all killed. Don't scream. Don't run. Doesn't matter. I've got the doors sealed. Bastards. I'm Dick Cheney.
Oh. Let's do some phone calls here quickly. Pat is calling from Surprise, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Pat, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. They had Ron Suskin on Keith Olbermann tonight, and they were playing some of the denials from some of these guys in the book, and he said, I've got all these guys on tape.
Mm.
You know?
Oh, Suskin did.
Yeah, he's got them all on tape. So,
yeah.
You know, a few of these guys have come out and said, well, I didn't say this, and I didn't say that. He said they're probably being threatened with their livelihood, their job,
their children's lives.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I'm curious, Mike. I've heard you talk about the Bush crime family. I first read that years ago on Sherman Skolnick, if you remember Sherman Skolnick at all.
The name is familiar, but...
Well, he died fairly recently in the last year or so, but he'd been calling the Bush crime family he'd been calling them that for years and years. So I
really?
Just wondered if you'd ever, have you ever read any Sherman Skolnick?
No, I haven't. And I swear I thought the idea was originated with me, the phrase, but apparently not.
Look up Sherman Skolnick. You would love his writings. This guy's been on to the Bush crime family for 30 years and has written all about all of their dirty dealings. You've got to look him up. It's Skolnick.
Yeah, I'm familiar. I'm familiar with his name, Pat. It's just that I have. I'm not familiar. I'm sure I've read pieces by him. I just could not call one up right now if my life depended on it. All right, thanks, Pat. I appreciate you checking in. I will do a Google on Skolnick and see what I can come up with. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. One more thing here. We got to go to a break. Okay, the latest from Nancy Pelosi. This was at Jonathan Turley's website, jonathanturley.org. This is from August 2nd. Nancy Pelosi's latest justification for not allowing impeachment to go forward is that Bush would never cooperate with his own impeachment. Nancy Pelosi is either has greater hubris than Barack Obama or is clinically insane. He would then why indict or try anybody, Nancy, much less someone who has committed high crimes and misdemeanors against your country, Ms. Pelosi? We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malone.
The second pillar of peace and security in our world is the willingness of free nations to retain aggression and evil by force.
What? To do what? 800-989-1480 is the phone number here. All right, Pelosi, Jonathan Turley, writing at his website, his blog site, says Pelosi has continued her search for book sales, and it seems her search for a plausible rationale for personally blocking any impeachment investigation of Bush. The latest explanation came in an interview with Time magazine. Apparently, she will not allow an investigation because Bush would never have supplied incriminating evidence against himself. It seems that House investigators rely on the accused to build an impeachment case. Turley writes, before moving to the obvious problems with this latest rationale, it is worth noting that it took the speaker's book tour to finally prompt her to answer questions about her decision. He quotes Pelosi's comment on The View that we talked about last week. And Turley writes, my understanding is that her office was inundated with copies of the various documented crimes alleged against Bush. Now Pelosi is claiming a different rationale. A question was asked of her. I guess this is a reporter, Nancy Shipes. of Woodstown, New Jersey. Why have you taken impeachment off the table as an option for President George W. Bush? Pelosi. I took it off the table a long time ago. You can't talk about impeachment unless you have the facts. And you can't have the facts unless you have cooperation from the administration. I think the Republicans would like nothing better than for us to focus on impeachment and take our eye off the ball of a progressive economic agenda. Oh, my God. So Turley then writes, tongue firmly planted in his cheek, I guess Nixon worked tirelessly for his own impeachment and resigned only out of a sense of self-loathing. What is particularly striking about this latest rationale is that it is so circular, as was Pelosi's first explanation. First, we could not start an investigation for impeachment without clear evidence of crimes, but we can only confirm evidence of crimes by investigating. Now, it appears the House cannot start impeachment proceedings unless the president and his party would agree to turn over incriminating evidence. Of course, the use of a president's authority to conceal or destroy evidence in such an investigation is in itself a potentially impeachable offense. Pelosi prevented a John Dean sort from coming forward by barring the hearings. In past hearings, we would have seen former Bush officials implicate the administration in investigations such as the firing of U.S. attorneys. Indeed, if this is Pelosi's rationale for barring impeachment, why is the House pursuing contempt on these other investigations? There is no longer any question in my mind, is there in yours, that Pelosi is complicit in whatever crimes might be, or at least accusations might be uncovered, if the House Judiciary Committee began impeachment hearings, which is nothing more than an investigation. This is the part that drives me crazy. You don't tell the police who come to a murder scene, well, you can't investigate the crime unless you have proof of the people that you're going to question were involved in the crime. And the cops are looking and say, what the hell are you talking about? How else are we to get the information unless we investigate? Oh, sorry, you can't investigate who killed this person lying on the living room floor inside this condo unless you can first tell us who killed this person lying on the floor in this condo. If you can tell us who killed this person, then we will allow you to investigate the facts about who killed this person. Jesus, God, that's what Pelosi is saying. How much more of this can you take? All right, let's open this up a bit. When we come back, there's just something I want to share with you about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yeah, tomorrow's the day once again. And then 3 days later, it's the second day once again. So I don't know who remembers anymore. I don't even know if it's taught in schools. Who knows what the Enola Gay was? Who knows who Paul Tibbetts was? Who knows Little Boy and Fat Man, I think. Fat Man? Yeah, Fat Man, Little Boy. Who knows what that is? And then we'll take some phone calls. The number is 800-989-1480. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. President Clinton should delete him. It's not hard. The CIA simply has no more job. Oh, my God. And mother, you can fix this. We rock over mixes, not 666s. Yo, this is a message to all that can hear it. If you've got secret information, now's the time to share it. Call your congresswoman, your senator, your mayor. It's time for all the scholars to unite with all the players. Rearrange and see. Times are definitely changing, G. They used to tap the phone. Now they tapping while you're paging me. It's crazy, B. Yet it's plain to see who the enemy, who's left, the NRA, the ATF, the AMA, okay, it's all irrelevant, cause in the new millennium, there'll be no central intelligence.
Feeling left
stressed out by right-wing talk radio? You found a home with Mike Malone.
It's about 25 before the hour. Pray 2 writes, regarding Nancy Pelosi's slip, not her underwear, her slip. Nancy just let something slip. The idea that Chucklenuts wouldn't cooperate is not an excuse she would give because it's too stupid. But what she really means is that Congress is afraid of him. You get anthrax letters. The anthrax turns out to be government-made. The FBI is obviously covering up. Who can she trust? The Bush crime family could kill the whole Congress, and the corporate media would spin it that now we need to have martial law. Well, okay. I know you really don't mean that, and I've gotten a couple of emails from people that are suggesting basically the same thing. It's fear. If we've come to that point where the Speaker of the House is terrified to allow impeachment hearings to go forward against a criminal outlaw regime, then game over anyway. So, on August 6th and August 9th in 1945, after 6 months of intense firebombing of 67 other Japanese cities, the nuclear weapon named Little Boy was dropped on the city of Hiroshima on August 6th, followed by August 9th, the detonation of the Fat Man over Nagasaki. To date, these are the only attacks with nuclear weapons in the history of warfare. Let me share this with you. When the bombs were dropped, I was very happy. The war would be over now, they said, and I was very happy. The boys would be coming home very soon, they said, and I was very happy. We showed them, they said, and I was very happy. They told us that the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki had been destroyed, and I was very happy. But in August of 1945, I was only 10 years old. The crew of the B-29 was so young and heroic, and in the photo they also looked very happy. For some reason, I clearly remember the name of the pilot, Paul Tibbetts. Of course, I remember the name of the plane, the Enola Gay. And yes, I remember the name of the bomb. It was called Little Boy. That made me smile. I was so proud to be an American that day because we had done something so remarkable. They said we were the first. We were Americans. We were powerful. But they didn't say that Little Boy had killed 66,000 people with his huge fireball that fateful day in August. They didn't say that Hiroshima was not a military target, but a city filled with men and women and children and animals who had no idea they were about to die so horribly. When you're 10, they don't always tell you everything. I don't think anyone made as big a fuss over the second plane or its crew. Are they even in the Smithsonian? Second best doesn't count, I suppose, but I remember wondering why they had done it again. Wouldn't the war be over anyway, like they said? Weren't the boys coming home very soon? Hadn't they already showed them how strong we were in Hiroshima? So they told me that the second bomb was called Fat Man. And that made me smile. I was even prouder to be an American that second day. They said this would be the end for sure. And after all, these people were the enemy. And you kill the enemy when you can. But they didn't tell me that Fat Boy had killed 39,000 human beings with another fireball on another day in August. They didn't tell me that Nagasaki was not a military target, but a city filled with, well, you know. They didn't even tell me that there were horses trapped in the flames of Nagasaki because I loved horses, and that would have made me sad. But when you're 10, they don't tell you everything. Today I'm no longer 10. I'm no longer happy when bombs fall, and the names Fat Man and Little Boy no longer make me smile because I now know the devastation and horror of burned bodies and twisted metal that result from the mushroom clouds. And I'm ashamed that on this day, Americans don't stop to remember what was done, and I'm horrified that my government has just killed thousands of defenseless men and women and children and animals who are not the enemy, and that the silence of America is deafening. Today, I'm so very sad that many young people don't even know about the Enola Gay and the mission of its crew. And I'm so terribly ashamed that the war we have just waged has been so devoid of the reality of death and pain. They haven't told us about the hundreds of thousands of civilians they've killed. They haven't shown us the devastation they have caused. They withhold the true numbers of our own military who die each day. They never mention the hundreds who have been terribly wounded.
War is surgical and sanitized, they tell us, in a very effective way to liberate people. They speak to us as if we were all 10. George W. Bush is not 10. He has announced to the world that he, as the leader of this great nation, has the right to use nuclear weapons once again. This time, he says, he has the right to char men and women and children and animals if he suspects their leaders of being a threat to us. He's not 10. He really isn't. Then why is he so very happy? And why, please tell me, why is he smiling? That was written, I think I read this last year. Reg over at TVNewsLies.org wrote that. So tomorrow and Saturday will be the 2 days that commemorate the nuclear bombing of two Japanese cities for no reason at all. And if you want to believe the revisionist history that, you know, we had to do it in order to stop an invasion of U.S. ground forces that may have resulted in the deaths of a million soldiers, go ahead and believe that. But it has been proven by historians over and over and over and over and over again to have been another one of these filthy lies put out there by historic or by revisionist historians. The Japanese had already made overtures about suing for peace. The Russians were watching from the Kamchatka Peninsula, waiting to declare. As a matter of fact, I think they did declare war on Japan for the sole reason at the time, the Soviet Union, of sharing in the spoils of war, or they were ready to declare war. I'm a little foggy on that. And our dropping the nuclear weapons was also a warning because U.S. experts like George Kennan already understood that the next foe that we would have to face would be the Soviet Union and its takeover of Eastern Europe. So it was a warning to the Russians. Look what we have. But nobody pays any attention to that history anymore. Phone calls. Neil is calling from Southern California, listening on KTLK. Neil, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. I've said this a million times to people, but they ain't going to do anything until the social order is threatened. That's just a fact, and nobody's ended the Vietnam War. Nobody's done anything major in the social system to end anything until they actually feel threatened. Just, you know, so what are we going to do, you know? Take a lesson from South Korea, take to the streets. Otherwise, what are we going to do? You know, you want to start a petition to recall Pelosi or Feinstein for appointing Mukasey or, you know, do something about it.
Well, I hear you. You know, the South Koreans take to the streets to protest the importation of U.S. beef. We have an outlaw criminal regime on our hands, even worse than Nixon, worse than Johnson. I remember the protests of the 60s against the war in Vietnam. I remember the protests of the 60s against the harassment and murder of civil rights workers in this country. I remember Students for a Democratic Society and the Weatherman faction and yada, 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 and how many people took to the streets involving human rights, civil rights, and anti-war activities where it concerned Vietnam. I don't know what has happened. I don't know. I can tell you this, that the vanguard of the protest movement back in the 60s were young people. The vanguard were students, whether they were at Columbia or University of California, Berkeley, or in Madison, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, University of Michigan, Jackson State University in Mississippi. You know, the list goes on and on. I don't know. You know, where is the vanguard? Old bastards like me did this. We're tired of it. We can't do it anymore.
But, well, yeah, you're right.
Where are the You know, where are the 20-year-olds?
Yeah, I know.
You know, where are the truck drivers and the moms and the Boy Scout troops and the Catholic priests? Where are the Jewish rabbis? Where are the religious leaders? Forget the evangelical Protestants. They love this because it's just takes them one step in their warped minds closer to Armageddon. So, you know, I don't know. I wish I had an answer, Neil. Well, I really do.
Christians have been co-opted by people who are absolutely anti-Christians. I mean, you know, it goes against anything Christ.
Well, Protestant evangelicals have been co-opted, yeah, but what about Catholic priests? What about the liberation theology movement? Whatever happened to that that tried to fight against the crazed Reagan-Bush years of the slaughter in Central America? You know, I have no idea. I don't know where the students are. I don't know where the 20-year-olds are. I don't know where the people are, the student leaders. Where's Mario Savio? Where's Mark Rudd? Where's... you know, just go down the list. Where are these guys? Where are where are the women? Where are they?
You got me. I have not. We're purposely fractionalized. I mean, the public relations industry has only grown more sophisticated since all of this happened. I mean, you look at our media. Look how that's changed since the 60s. It's completely.
I hear you.
You know, completely illicit. I mean, it's not.
I hear you. Thanks, Neil. God, I wish I had answers. I wish you had answers so you could give them to me. You know, where's Abby Hoffman? Where's Rennie Davis? Where's Eldridge Cleaver? Where's Stokely Carmichael? Damn.
I know the minds behind them are riddled full of holes. Not to be trusted with their hands at the controls. Their eyesight is twisted by the glory of their careers. The heaped praise of flattery is music to their ears. As I listen to them talk about how it hasn't happened yet, I play in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, a Russian roulette. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Russian roulette. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, a Russian.
Doing talk radio right. From the left, it's more of Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, Captain Green Bay writes in about, you know, where are the leaders? My question. The Vanguard, Kathy writes, was certainly young folks. We were all afraid of the draft. And the jackasses learned from that. Now there's no real draft, just one of those who signed up voluntarily and get stop-lost. One for those who sign up voluntarily and get stop loss. And the 60s were a relatively stable time. Jobs weren't being sent overseas. College was affordable. Life wasn't so bad. Naomi Klein talks about disaster capitalism, carry it a step further, keep people insecure financially, socially, etc., and they won't object to military adventures. Kathy in Green Bay. The other obvious fact, of course, I don't know if we qualify in this country yet, but revolution or resistance never arises except from the middle class. The poor, the really desperate poor, do not lead revolutions. They may join in at some point, but revolution arises from the middle class. And if you take a look at the 60s, there was a social revolution. It certainly wasn't an armed rebellion, but it was a social revolution, and it came specifically from the middle class, mostly white, but also non-white. And the middle class now, I guess you can make the argument, is being beaten into a bloody pulp. But we're still not, are we, at that point where resistance from the middle class is something that has left or has it? I don't know. You know, if you're a regular listener to this program, you know I have no answers. I only have questions, just like you. I don't have a clue. Jerry is calling from Spartanburg, South Carolina, listening on the internet. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike.
Hey,
I was 18 years old in 1951, I joined the military to avoid the draft and was shipped to Korea. And on my way, I had to travel across the entirety of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way, I saw two cities that were just heaping piles of black ashes as far as the eye could see. And that memory is, at 75, is still very plain in my consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't believe we're talking about nuclear war again, possibly against Iran or any other country. I think everybody should see what I saw.
Yeah. The pictures are there for anyone who wants to do a search, a internet search of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There are pictures, but to see it the way you saw it, the way a lot of U.S. military personnel saw it. When did you go through those cities?
I went in 1951.
In 51.
Nothing had really been done to retrieve those cities by then. Mm-hmm. Japan was still in ruin. And I couldn't believe that what I saw. I didn't even expect to see it. They tried to block it off along the the train, alongside the train, but you could still see the majority of the damage still there.
It must have scared the bejesus out of you.
Well, you know, I was on the way to another war, and it just seems like it's been an endless nightmare since then.
Were you involved in the landing at Incheon?
No, I was aboard a big tanker in the Navy, but we did sail up along all the coast of Korea, Incheon, and all those areas,
mm-hmm.
by the fuel for the big battleships and the carriers,
right,
and so forth.
And you had joined the Army or the Navy?
Yes, uh huh.
And
yeah, I had to join the Navy because, you know, it was either that or be drafted into Korea, and I had some friends that gone there. And
I hear that.
I didn't entertain Pork Chop Hill too much.
Yeah. How long did you serve, Jerry?
I served 4 years.
4 years? I guess back then they still called it furlough. Were you granted furlough to come home at any period of time after you'd been in a combat zone?
No, it was a long time because they wouldn't let me come home when we came back. I had to go back again before I.
Oh, really?
I got leave again, so
mm-hmm.
it was a long, long bitter experience. I never dreamed that I would see what I saw, though. Of course, I could see them bombing the hell out of Korea with all the napalm and all that. That war is not talked about very much today either, but it was just as criminal as any other war we've been in since then.
Yeah. Does it intrigue you? That may be the wrong word, intrigue, that we still have not come to a peace agreement with North Korea, that all we have is an armistice after all?
Yes.
Is that insane?
Yeah, I am. I thought, here's a war that's been going on for 50-something years now, and it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, listen, I'm glad you called. Thank you very much for the input and the eyewitness account. I'm sure that will stay with you for your entire life. What you
Nobody
saw.
Nobody could ever really describe it. No way. No photograph or anything else. It's just stark reality of that horror with all those bodies cremated there was something I can't ever forget.
All right, Jerry, thanks. Take care, man, okay? Appreciate it. Yikes. I don't think I would have been able to handle. And what did Jerry say? It was he's 75 years old now. I can remember my uncles who served in World War II a few years before the Korean conflict telling me about what they witnessed after the firebombing of Dresden, which made the book Slaughterhouse-5 even more spooky to me. Vonnegut's book. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network.
story in your eyes. It's been shining down upon me now.
Welcome back. It's 7 past the hour. This is the NovaM Radio Network. My name is Mike Malloy. Thanks for hanging out as long as you have. We still have about 50 minutes of the program left, so hang on. Let's go back to your phone calls. Michael is calling from South Carolina, listening on the Internet. Michael, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Mike and company.
Hi.
I lived in Japan for about 6.5 years. I was in the military and absolutely loved the place. I lived right outside of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
But on occasion, I was forced and able to travel to Hiroshima.
What is the correct pronunciation, or is it, does it?
You got me. I'm a white boy, man.
you know? I've heard it. I've heard it both ways, but mostly I've heard it Hiroshima. But anyway, yeah. What was you went there? I would assume long after the bombs fell.
Yeah, in the early 80s.
Okay.
And the first time that I went through the Peace Park, went through the museum. And they gave you a big honking cassette recorder with earphones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was in the early 80s.
Right.
And, you know, with an English tape in the recorder. And so you could walk around and the tape would narrate things to you. And right behind me was a bunch of Japanese schoolgirls in their uniform. And I'm watching all of this mayhem that is played. Talk about feeling like the fart in the room.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you if this would require some kind of deep evaluation, I guess, on your part. I don't know if you or I would be capable of doing this, but the Germans who looked at pictures of the Holocaust after World War II, not the ones who were forced to go into the camps to see what their leaders had done,
right,
but the ones in the 70s and 80s who, the young people who saw photographs of what their government had done in the 30s and 40s, I just wonder if their feelings would resemble those of an American who, as you did, went 50 years or 40 years after the fact and saw the destruction that we had wrought against this country. Now, granted, there's a difference between the wholesale murder of the Jews in Europe and the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki as an act of war. There, I understand the difference. So I'm trying to get beyond that, though, and just understand what Americans feel on seeing the death we brought as opposed to what German, or in comparison to what Germans felt.
Americans don't have a clue. My honest opinion, Americans don't have any idea about what went on there. You know, but let me bring out a couple of the things that will never go out of my brain.
Okay.
A title page out of a book where the ink burned out of the page.
Mm.
And the book was closed.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it would have all burned up.
Right, right.
Twisted steel, you know, all burned clothing, you know, photographs of you know, the imprints of floral patterns of dresses
mm-hmm.
burned into the skin.
Yeah.
And one that they had just recently added to the museum when I was there in the early 80s, there was a big bank building that they actually rebuilt. and the bank went back into business. That building was reused for, you know, 30 years, and they decided to tear it down. On the front, the bomb went off just before 9 o'clock in the morning, before right. bank hours, and some poor guy had been sitting on the stoop. His shadow was burned into that.
You know, I think I've seen that photograph. I was going to say the one that was particularly disturbing to me were the photographs of what used to be people, but were now just imprinted
shadows. Yeah,
it's absolutely horrifying stuff. What brought you back to? Was South Carolina your home, Michael?
No, I'm actually I was showbiz, but anyways, that's another story.
Oh, okay.
but something that nobody else knows, and everybody's fire up your Google Earth. Not 50 miles from Hiroshima. Have you ever heard of an island called Eta Jima?
No, I haven't.
That is where the Imperial Japanese, now Naval Self-Defense Force, mm-hmm. at that time it was the Imperial Navy, they're Annapolis.
Hmm.
50 miles from Hiroshima.
Wow.
And I have also toured that facility. I've got, as the musician, performed there.
Mm-hmm.
It's on a small island, not 50 miles from Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
Why the hell didn't we bomb the hell out of that?
Right. Well, I think that is one of the questions. Michael, thank you. Scary stuff to provide an eyewitness account. You're the second person from South Carolina tonight, oddly enough, who's provided an account. Our first caller actually was there and saw the horror, and your account being there 30 years later, 40 years later, equally scary, I mean, to me. But, the question always was, why Hiroshima? Hiroshima, it's my understanding, was not a primary target. I forget what the primary target was that the Enola Gay was supposed to, over which the Enola Gay was supposed to drop the atomic bomb. But because of weather conditions, I believe I've got this right, or maybe it was a second city, but Hiroshima was a backup target. And the objective was to commit so much chaos, destruction, and absolute murder that the sensibilities of the Japanese Imperial Command and the rest of the world would be so incredibly shocked that the only reaction would be unconditional surrender. The dropping of the second bomb, I think, beyond any argument, was absolutely unnecessary. Granted, there can be argument about the first bomb. I think that the historic, revisionist historians would like us to believe that it was necessary to drop the bomb on Hiroshima. I don't agree with that, but at least there's wiggle room for argument there or debate. But as far as Nagasaki was concerned, to 3 days later destroy and incinerate the population of a second city, to me, was just, it bordered on uncivilized. That's not the word I'm looking for, because all war is a result of the restraints of civilization disappearing. But it was barbaric, just absolutely barbaric to nuclear bomb the second city. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
I'll
and conservatives love to hate. It's Mike Malloy.
Anyone past the hour, we have two open lines here if you'd like to comment tonight, 800-989-1480. Merrill is calling from Miami, listening on WINZ. Hey, Merrill.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Good.
I'm just thinking that the reason that there are no students that are protesting, a la,
Remy right.
in the 60s, is because there's no draft.
Yeah, several people have emailed in with that, pointing that out, and I guess that was the big impetus back in the day for people to protest. It was enlightened self-interest that seemed to dovetail with what the rest of the country was feeling, too. Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah, I think that the people who were protesting them were also really, idealistically into protesting the war. I mean, I thought that they also were against the war, and they knew what Johnson and Nixon were up to,
mm-hmm.
And I think that there's no such interest right now for some reason, and I can't explain it. I just can't explain it, but I think that, when Charles Rangel came up with his idea to, institute a draft, I was really in favor of that because I thought that once parents and kids felt that, whoa, wait a second, this is going to touch us,
mm-hmm.
I think this is a good idea.
Yeah, the thing that intrigues me is that, granted, the draft may in the 60s may have clarified the minds of people of draft age that this is going to touch me if I don't protest, but in a less direct way, the actions of the Bush crime family are going to touch in a very negative way everybody in this country, even people not yet born, and this is what I can't understand how. Well, I can understand it, but I just can't accept the idea that we have become so anesthetized to what is happening to our country that we don't, to hell with the 20-year-olds. What about the 50-year-olds? What about the people who have adult children and grandchildren at this point who may be concerned that their grandchildren may not have a secure environment in which they can just live, just have a normal life? If the 20-year-olds today are not emotionally equipped or are too separated from what is going on because there's no draft to protest, then why aren't the 50-year-olds out there? Go ahead.
No, I agree with you. I mean, look at John McCain. His son is in Iraq. And he's like gung-ho.
Well, who, John McCain's son is gung-ho?
Yeah, no, John McCain is gung-ho, and his son is in Iraq.
Well, McCain, you have to understand, his father and his grandfather, probably back to God only knows how many generations back, they have been involved in military operations, whether those operations were honorable or not. So I'm not surprised that McCain's son is involved. This is a family brain-scrubbing tradition that seems to go from generation to generation to generation in that particular family. Go ahead, Merrill.
Well, there's something about that. John McCain is like, to me, and I'm sorry to keep, pushing in on this, but John McCain to me is like Bush. They both had fathers who were achievers. And they both are on the couch in this. I got them on the couch. But they both have a lot to prove to their predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
And John McCain is a loser. He never achieved anything. He was a prisoner of war. He never achieved, he never even got to, to admiral. And they made him a commander because he was a prisoner of war. And I think that he still feels like he's a loser.
Well, I think you're right. And I think the same thing, of course, as you point out, the same thing applies to Bush. You have these Oedipally struck boys that grow up to become men, and they're just absolutely crazed. Thanks, Merrill. I appreciate you checking in. Irish Dave writes, Mike, I don't need to tell you that Hiroshima, Dresden, the Tokyo firebombing, Nagasaki, were all terrorist acts. And to demonstrate to the USSR that the US of A had a super weapon and would use it anytime, any place we chose. Here's tonight's fun fact. The largest Christian population of any Japanese city in 1945, Hiroshima. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Life's too short to listen to right-wing radio. It's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. William in Hollywood writes, part of the reason there was so much protest in the 60s was the news showed the bodies coming home and footage almost every single night showing what was going on in Vietnam. One main thing we certainly don't have now. Yeah, well, that's by design, right? Back to your phone calls. Tim is calling from Los Angeles, listening on KTLK. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Ooh, this is a hot topic, by the way, because, 6 months after 9/11, my aunt died from thyroid cancer from being a survivor in Hiroshima.
Really?
Uh-huh. Yes. And it's pronounced Hiroshima, by the way.
Hiroshima.
Hiroshima, you're right. Well, don't worry about it.
All right.
But it's a story she told. It's so evil. It's so, oh my gosh. It's so wicked. I mean, the way she survived was she was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And she remembered that when the bomb exploded, I guess one of the walls collapsed. And they ran towards the other side of the wall, which was still erect, and just students were piling on top of students,
mm-hmm.
and the teacher was on top. My aunt doesn't really remember how long she was up, maybe a couple of hours, days, or even weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But when she crawled out with another fellow classmate, the other students and teacher were dead. So, you know, what protected them were the dead bodies in the wall from the blast.
Mm.
But as they left the classroom, you know, she and a classmate went their separate ways. She said if there's a place such as hell, this is it.
Yeah.
I mean, besides the destruction, besides, you know, everything being destroyed, She saw women who were, you know, I guess who were pregnant, dragging their fetuses by the umbilical cord, dead, burnt, crisped. She tried to help people.
Mm-hmm.
She said that one of the people asked for water. My aunt gave them water. They thanked her and died. And another one where the person was trapped, so she would reach out with her hands, pull on the hands, and the burnt flesh would just come out, and all you saw was just skeleton, the bones from the hand.
Mm.
And she was, oh my God, she was like destroyed, you know, for lack of a better word, at what she saw. And my aunt, back in 2001, you know, slipped into a coma. And I saw her, you know, in the coma in the hospital. Her left ear was one big gigantic keloid. It just melted. I mean, the flesh melts in this intense heat. The radiation that went into her body, into her thyroid, just spread and was just eating her up. I was angered. I was sad. I had all these emotions. I knew she was going to die because they decided to drop that goddamn bomb on a city. I mean, it was not a military base. I mean, I don't like bombings. I don't like wars. I don't like any of that crap. But they killed my aunt. And when I was doing even further research, you know, there are Americans out there who would say the bombings were justified. You know, it was used to save, you know, the U.S. troops. Blah blah blah. And I tell people there were American POWs in Hiroshima. Americans, the U.S. killed Americans.
Mm-hmm.
They died in POW camps, prisoner war camps. Soldiers were dead, melted. And there are, like, I think there are names in the Hiroshima Memorial site with American names. But people don't realize that the U.S. is willing to sacrifice its own. And now there's a call. Bush wants to have a goddamn war with Iran and wants to do the same damn thing. What is this with this country? I mean, do they hate Asians that much or something? Don't they realize what will happen? Or is it just... they just don't care. They just don't give a damn. I can't grasp why they would do something evil and bad as that.
Well, you're not alone. I mean, there are other Americans like you who simply can't get our minds around any of this. Let me ask you, Tim, were any other members of your family in Japan at the time, just your aunt?
See, my aunt was in Hiroshima. My mom was in Japan, too. They were shooting at her in another part of Japan. And we had relatives in Tokyo, and they survived about 30 seconds over Tokyo and the bombing in Tokyo.
Any of your family members, I would assume at the time, I'm just guessing here, lived in California. I'm also assuming that you're of Japanese descent. Were any of your family members put in internment camps?
My dad and my, you know, grandparents on my father's side wished he was in the concentration camp. Why? Because they had the opportunity to leave California, actually move inland 350 miles more. They went up to Idaho. They used to beat the ass out of him because he was Japanese. They called him Little Tojo. They used to bury him in the snow, kick him, used to spit on him, call him all these racist things.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard this, and my dad's today, he's like sick. I mean, he's destroyed. I want to go up to Rexburg, Idaho, and beat the living crap out of the people. I want to beat those people up. I'm so angered I want to do that. But I'm a progressive. I won't do it. That's what's stopping me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's stopping me. I'm a liberal. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a neocon where I seek revenge. I mean,
All right, Tim, listen, I'm glad you called in. I know that it's a struggle to tell your story. I appreciate what you shared with us, all right?
Oh, Mike, one last thing, if it's
sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Remember you were saying who's out there, who's making the change, who is protesting?
Right.
There's a group called We Are Change.
Right.
I'm a member of We Are Change LA. We're going out there. We're protesting the war. We're protesting Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran. We're protesting what the Bush crime family is doing. That's what we're doing. But we're considered as, you know, conspiracy theories, theorist wingnuts, conspiracy theory wingnuts.
Right.
But we're going out there. So there's still hope out there, people. And I want to say thank you again, Mike.
All right, Tim, thanks for checking in. I just feel sorrow for what you have experienced in your family. Are the events of August 5th and or August 6th and August 9th still taught in school? I guess middle school would be the appropriate place. Well, maybe high school. In this country, do those dates mean anything? The other night, I was wondering if students today were taught about the American Union movement, and the quick answer that comes to me is no. I just wonder if the closing days of World War II in the Pacific part of that war, if those events are still taught in school. I was taught that. I was told about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I can remember my social studies textbook from, I want to say it was fifth or sixth grade, pictures of Paul Tibbetts and his crew. Isn't it interesting that we don't know, not readily know, the crew of the B-29 that flew over Nagasaki, but we do know Hiroshima. But I remember seeing the pictures of Fat Boy and or Fat Man and Little Boy, the nuclear bombs, in my textbook. And I just wonder if today that is taught as part of U.S. history. Probably not. Probably not. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Muller. This is Nova M.
If you hear the song I sing, you will understand. Listen. You hold the key to love and fear, all in your trembling. Just one key unlocks them both. It's there at your command. Come on, people now. Smile on your brother, everybody. Get...
Tammy for the hour. Boy, time flies when you're having fun, doesn't it? I can't believe the program is almost over. Thanks to our technical staff, Ian Huff, Billy Foster, and Ben Birch, our creative staff, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Sharon Gordy. Executive producer of the program is Catherine Bay. Back to your phone calls as quickly as we can here. Bruce is calling from California, listening on the Internet. Hey, Bruce.
Good evening, Mike.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Sure.
And the main reason that urban targets were selected was because they wanted to see the effect that those bombs would have on an urban target. We got the military that actually wanted to see what would happen.
Right.
If you remember all of the tests that were done after the war ended, bombing in a week. We talk atoll in the Pacific, all the different things that were done to test the effectiveness and the destructive power of those bombs.
Yeah, especially when we got to the thermonuclear bombs, the hydrogen bombs. I've read that before. An agreement with what you're saying, that part of it was an experiment where live human beings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were to be used.
Exactly.
Right.
You could actually, they wanted to determine what, you know, how much destruction would be caused by this. I mean, if you think about it for a minute, that bomb could have been dropped offshore, and the wave that would have been caused, the heat blast, the massive mushroom cloud, et cetera, would have been enough to have intimidated any population.
Right.
And it wasn't necessary to destroy an urban center that wasn't even a military target, except that they needed to see it.
Well, again, like I say, Bruce, I've heard that before, and I certainly do agree with it, that it was a laboratory experiment to determine medical results, physical results, environmental results. Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate you checking in. And the fact that we use live human beings in the experiment was a clear indication that this was an act of terrorism. I remember reading when Colonel Tibbets died. Well, he was promoted to General. Paul Tibbets, the pilot of the Enola Gay, when he died, what was it, within the past 5, 6, 10 years? It's been relatively recently. He said that he never had a sleepless night after the bombing of Hiroshima, that he knew full well what that bombing run had accomplished, if that's the right word. And he had no problems with it, which I think, to me, I remember thinking at the time when I read that, that was a clear indication of the power of absolute brainwashing. And not necessarily the kind of brainwashing that must occur in the military if people are being programmed to kill and to die if necessary. A different kind of brainwashing, a political brainwashing, that it was so complete in the case of General Tibbets that the fact that he alone, and I don't care how it's spun, it makes no difference how it's incorporated into a strategic decision made in Washington or a tactical decision made by the commanders of the Pacific War. It doesn't matter. The pilot of that B-29 was Paul Tibbets. And he and his flight crew, but he, because he was the captain, was directly responsible in an instant, in an immeasurably small amount of time, directly responsible for the deaths of 70,000 people. that quickly. And subsequent to the explosion, over the next several months, several years, the deaths of tens of thousands more. And how Paul Tibbets could say that he never had a sleepless night is, I can't believe that Paul Tibbets was a demon from hell and therefore completely amoral, completely without conscience. I can't believe that. Maybe he was, but I can't believe that. So what I'm left with is the idea, the belief that Paul Tibbets had been so thoroughly politically scrubbed, his mind completely scrubbed, that he was able to deny the humanity or the lives of the people that were murdered on October 6th, 1945. I don't know how one does that. How is that accomplished? Or was Paul Tibbets lying? Did he suffer the tortures of the damned every single night in his dreams? I don't know. He lived into his 80s, didn't he? He was a relatively old man when he died. I'm not blaming Tibbetts for the decision. He didn't make the decision. Nor did the pilot of the second aircraft that flew over Nagasaki. But it was Tibbetts who was the captain of the ship that dropped that piece of hell. I don't know. I guess it really doesn't matter, does it? I'll see you tomorrow night, Truth Seekers. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.